Welcome to another podcast at slysoffice.com, and this is all part of our Labor Day special, so I want to thank our Labor Day sponsors, Teamsters Local 695, Madison Teachers Incorporated, Madison Firefighters Local 311, and the Operating Engineers Local 139. These guys are always there for me, and I appreciate it. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation with us. Comrade Nichols?
Comrade?
If you think about the remarks that Donald Trump allegedly made, his pattern of treating workers in general that work for the government and in the private sector is really rotten. He may be the most anti-worker, and certainly people in the military are workers. He's got to be the most anti-worker president we've ever had.
Without a question. Elected on the most anti-worker platform of any major political party ever seen. And that's an important thing to understand. One of the mistakes that people make about Donald Trump is to only look at his bluster, right? And I think we're so used to saying that, politicians are all talk and they don't do anything. In a weird kind of way, Trump kind of breaks that pattern. He is all talk. There's no question of that, except that he also does stuff. And if you look at his administration, it has been a militantly anti-labor administration, anti-union administration, in its appointments, in its policies, in its strategies, and I would add that it's uniquely and dangerously anti-labor at this point, because Eugene Scalia, who is the Secretary of Labor, has such a pro-corporate bias.
Yes.
And such a pro-profit bias that, as we have talked about the very difficult process of reopening the economy coming out of coronavirus, which we're nowhere near.
He is not a Pope Francis Catholic.
No way. In fact, though, his policies are, he reinforces Donald Trump's desperation to reopen the economy. Now, Trump wants to do it so he can get reelected, right? He wants to, pretend that everything's fine. Scalia's different. Scalia has always been a bagman lawyer for corporate interests, and he is using his position as Secretary of Labor to dial down regulations, dial down protections, so that the economy can be reopened on the cheap, i.e. that, workers are sort of, tossed in, not given any.
This is the Rick Essenberg Bradley Foundation model.
It is an incredibly dangerous and destructive model. It is bad for workers. It's bad for society. It's very, very bad for the future. And I cannot begin to emphasize that if we were to think about the most dangerous member of the Trump administration, a lot of people would say, Betsy DeVos or Stephen Miller. And these are, terrible people who do awful, awful things. But I would argue that Scalia, being in charge of the Labor Department at this point, is, in the broadest sense, the most dangerous to the most people.
So let's. This story's from ABC, and you've got to listen to this whole thing because the end is actually kind of a coup de grace with Jonathan Carl, who, by the way, has just written a book about Donald Trump. This is from ABC.
Joe Biden came out today with his angriest denunciation of Donald Trump yet, pointing to an article in The Atlantic alleging that the president referred to American war dead as suckers and losers.
If the article is true, and it appears to be based on other things he said, it is absolutely damnable. It is a disgrace. It is so un-American. It is so unpatriotic.
The article, based entirely on anonymous sources, portrays the president as someone with contempt for military service. It describes a November 2018 trip to France. The president was supposed to visit a World War I cemetery where American troops are buried. But the White House canceled the visit, saying bad weather made it impossible for the president's helicopter to fly. The Atlantic article alleges Trump said, "Why should I go to that cemetery? It's filled with losers." The president heard about the story while in Air Force One last night. As soon as he landed, he summoned reporters to the dark tarmac and angrily denied it all.
I would be willing to swear on anything that I never said that about our fallen heroes.
Multiple people who were with the president on the France trip, including Trump critic John Bolton, said today on the record that they never heard the president call dead American troops suckers or losers. Joe Biden said he finds the story believable because of the president's past comments, including what he said in 2015 about John McCain.
He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war
Five
hero.
And a half years
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
And Biden said the allegations in the article show Trump is not fit to be commander-in-chief.
How would you feel if you had a kid in Afghanistan right now? How would you feel if you lost a son, daughter, husband, wife?
The president firmly denied the story again today, saying those who serve in the military are heroes.
It's a fake story written by a magazine that was probably not going to be around much longer, but it was a totally fake story.
All right, John Carl joins us now from the White House. And John, President Trump speaking with reporters just moments ago, and you asked him if he regrets insulting John McCain's military service.
Tom, he told me that he respected McCain, but he made it perfectly clear that he has absolutely no regret for what he said about him, saying that he is not a war hero, that he preferred people who aren't captured. As the president told me just minutes ago, quote, I say what I say.
So he calls this story fake, and then he doubles down on the completely inappropriate remarks about POWs.
And, in fact, remarks that literally confirm the mindset. I mean, literally, what he was saying about McCain is, you know, so similar to this attitude as regards those who serve. And those who actually find themselves in the most perilous and the most difficult of circumstances. And, you know, people don't become POWs sitting in the office, right, back at the base. They become POWs when they're flying a plane or in the front lines or, you know, in a very difficult, dangerous situation. And so far from being losers, they're the ones who go out, you know, and take the biggest risks in war, usually, and sometimes those risks, those brave efforts end up putting you in a terrible situation. But that doesn't make you a loser. It doesn't make you not heroic. And the interesting thing is, if Trump believes that about McCain, why wouldn't you expect that he would say similar things in this, you know, very casual, very dismissive way? He may actually not believe that he said it, you know. And I understand that he may think, well, I didn't, you know, that wasn't really what I was saying. You know, maybe I was trying to say something else. But the fact that if the Atlantic, and by the way, many, many other publications now that have,
including Fox News, now he wants the reporter that from Fox News that verified this story, he wants her fired.
You know, and I'm sure he wants the Atlantic to close down.
I don't think the Atlantic's going to close down. Something just tells me they're okay.
And they've been around about they've been around since, I believe, before the Civil War.
That isn't going to stop him from killing Stars and Stripes because he doesn't like their coverage.
How they may, it sounds like he's backing off that, you know, because apparently that looks, I think Stars and Stripes, the great military publication, which actually does good journalism on all sorts of stuff. It looked like they were slated to get shut down, but then the news that they were slated to get shut down paralleled this news about Trump. And suddenly Trump's like, oh, no, I wouldn't shut this great But, you know, here's the bottom line. Sorry. You know, I've thought about this a lot over the last few days. You know, I grew up in Union Grove, which is a very small town. It was 970 people when I was born. And the big event of the year in Union Grove was Memorial Day. And everybody would walk from the high school mile through town down to the cemetery, following the vets who would march.
Where my uncle is buried.
In the Union Grove Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, it's a
Korean War veteran.
Well, mm-hmm. Then every year we decorated his grave because my mom and other people organized to put a flag and a marker that recognized which war the person fought in.
Well, he just went there, you know, he was just buried there a couple years ago, but And they were actually, so they were actually close. This was last year. I showed up, and the Boy Scouts had just put flags in front of all those graves.
It's an annual thing.
Yeah.
I can't emphasize. And like my mom and her friends, it used to be when they were a little younger, it was like a two-day project. They went to all the little farm cemeteries, every place where there was a vet, they put a marker. When we went there on Memorial Day, though, we would stand around the graves, and after the ceremony, the 21-gun salute and everything, we'd be there for an hour or so, usually, and people would talk around the graves. They would tell stories. My mom would always tell the story of our Revolutionary War veteran, Phineas Cadwell. But the most interesting guy there was our postman in Union Grove, Charlie Weiler. And Charlie was this big, strapping guy, but he had a really kind of torn-up arm on one side. And that was because he had gone into France after D-Day with, I think it was the 5th Armored Division, and they had fought their way up into Belgium in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was very badly wounded. And his unit had to keep fighting, but he was taken by an ambulance corps, put in an ambulance, and they were going to take him back to a field hospital. And on the way, they were ambushed by the German SS. The ambulance was captured. He was taken to a German prisoner camp, a small camp that they had set up there. And then the next day, U.S. forces overran the camp and freed Charlie and got him back, got him treated, and he continued to fight. And so that's a POW there. And I kind of don't think he was a loser.
One of the more disturbing parts of this story is that Donald Trump didn't want veterans that had been injured in war in the parade. And so the first thing I thought about was this. In 1988, when Bob Kerry got elected to the United States Senate, I suspect you'll remember this. He sang a song called Waltzing Matilda.
It does go like this. When I was a young man, I carried me pack and lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's Green Basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, there's work to be done. And they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as our ship pulled away from the quay. Amidst all the cheers, flag waving and tears, we sailed off to Gallipoli. How well I remember that terrible day, the blood stains, the sand and the water. And how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs to the slaughter. Johnny Turkey was ready, he'd primed himself well. He rained us with bullets, he chased us with shells. And in 5 minutes' blood, he kicked us all to hell, nearly chased us clear back to Australia. And the band played Waltzing Matilda, and we stopped to bury our slain. The Turks buried theirs, and we buried ours, and we started all over again. For 10 weary weeks, we kept ourselves alive in a mad world of blood, death, and fire. For 10 weary weeks, I kept myself alive, while around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me ass over head, and when I awoke in my hospital bed, I saw what it had done, and I wished I were dead. Never knew there were worse things than dying. And the band played Waltzing Matilda around the green bush far near. To hunt pendant eggs, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. They collected the wounded, the legless, the maimed, the poor wounded heroes of Suvla. The legless, the armless, the blind, the insane, and shipped us all back to Australia. And as our ship pulled into Salikakee, I looked down at where my legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me to mourn and to grieve and to pity. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as it carried us down the gangway. and nobody's cheered. They just stood and stared and turned all their faces away. And now every April I sit on my porch and watch the parade pass before me. I watch my old comrades, how proudly they march, renewing old dreams and lost glory. The old men march proudly, all bent stiff and sore, the tired old men from a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. And the band played Waltzing Matilda, and the old men answer the call. Year by year, their numbers get fewer. Someday no one will march here at all. Waltzing Matilda, Waltzing Matilda, who'll go waltzing Matilda with me? And their ghosts can be heard as they pass by the Billy Bong. Who'll go a waltzing Matilda with me?
Well, sorry, I had to play the whole thing.
It's one of the greatest anti-war songs in history. And yet it's one that's profoundly valued by a lot of vets. And I know because I've actually spent a decent amount of time in Australia. And, you know, there is a song called Waltzing Matilda. And then there's this song.
This song, yes.
Yeah. And the only thing I would say is that, to top that off, I had a chance to interview Bob Carey a number of times. And, you know, it's there are moments when you wish somebody was in the Senate when they're not there. And this would be a very fascinating day to hear Bob Carey's response to Donald Trump.
Well, he was on television the night this story broke, and here's what he said about the situation.
Well, look, it's completely consistent. There's nothing surprising about the president's attitude towards people who choose to serve their country. What concerns me, Lawrence, that we have a higher fraction of men and women who served in the military who are committing suicide. And oftentimes, they feel like they're losers. They feel like they're suckers. Especially those of us who are injured, we do feel that we might make people uncomfortable when they're around us. And I just say to those men and women who've served, you're not losers. You're not suckers. You served your country, and we value that service. You've given us more than we have a right to expect, frankly. And don't be concerned that the president doesn't understand service, because all of us who have served do understand. And we're very grateful to you, Seth, and others who have stepped to the plate and served it. And two wars at times were quite unpopular, very much like Vietnam.
And Seth Moulton's eyes were tearing up, as were Lawrence O'Donnell's.
As are mine. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, there's one final thing as we talk about Trump and some of the things he's alleged to have said. You've brought out many of the things that I shouldn't say alleged. I mean, these are the things that many, many people have confirmed to many, many publications and media outlets that he said. Was something else in it that was interesting in the Atlantic piece. It said at a certain point they were talking about this Marine unit from World War One that had suffered horrible losses, and that was a cemetery that he didn't want to go visit. And he asked, who were the good guys in this fight?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I thought, it just made me think the extent to which Donald Trump grew up in a different America than I grew up in. Wherever he grew up, however he grew up, it wasn't how I grew up. Because you know me, I'm probably as anti-war as you're going to find. I'm a pretty big critic of just about any war that isn't very clearly against fascism. And yet, I grew up with vets of wars. When I was a little kid, I grew up with World War One vets in Union Grove. Miles Hewlett, who was in the veterinary corps, you know, took care of the horses in France during World War One. And these people, I grew up knowing them as heroic figures, not because of what they did in a war, but because at a very difficult time, and World War One was not a popular war, they stepped up and they went and served. Sometimes they had to, sometimes they volunteered, but the bottom line was that they were there, and they came back and they told us the stories of their service, and they didn't usually try to make themselves out to be perfect individuals or perfect heroes. What they did was they talked to, they talked about their experiences.
Well, we've got a new generation of, the Seth Moultons and Connor Lambs and Tammy Duckworths and Amy McGraths that have served in unpopular wars, and they probably have a lot to say right now. Stand by. John Nichols with us at sliceoffice.com on our Labor Day special. We're back on our Labor Day special. John Nichols with us from the Capital Times. I want to thank our sponsors, of course, Madison Computer Works, Jeff's Guitar Clinic, and the law firm of Gingrich, Thompson, and Walks. All right, so let's talk a little bit about this Labor Day. It's a catastrophic time for the American worker. Vice President Biden talked about the K-shaped recovery yesterday on how the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer right now. Your thoughts?
Look, I think that's the great undercovered story of the moment. We have mass unemployment in America, and it extends from the coronavirus pandemic, but even before the coronavirus pandemic, we had an incredibly uneven prosperity in this country. It was very, very good for the very wealthy. It was very, very good for some folks, but not for everyone.
Well, and we saw validation of your point in how quickly people were showing up at food banks when the whole pandemic started, which means a lot of people were just hanging on by their fingernails when they were working.
Oh yeah, no, and people were working three jobs, and so we had an uneven recovery from the last economic meltdown where they bailed out the banks and didn't bail out people. Now we're hit with another economic meltdown, and it's far more severe. Higher unemployment, higher levels of unemployment. And a much higher level of small businesses being undermined and weakened, farms in trouble. I mean, we've got a tough situation. And here's the reason why I say it's a severely undercovered story. The people have hung on, right? They've done their best to get by with unemployment insurance, with, picking up whatever work they can, kind of muddling through, and small businesses, farms, and others trying to survive, and they've gotten this far, but there really isn't a plan for the fall and for going forward, and that's the crisis of the moment, slide. That there's no sense of urgency on the part of our federal government, or I should say, at least on the part of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate and President Trump. They have allowed necessary recovery initiatives to languish since May. The House did pass something, but it's languished since May. Even what the House did was insufficient. And so my fear is that we're heading into a fall and a winter where a lot of the wheels are going to come off this economy in fundamental ways, and people will suddenly realize how severe it all is. I think working class people already realize, but I'm talking about people in power.
Yeah, well, that's
the November.
I hope that the former vice president continues to hammer on this, and he did a good job the other day, but I think it's got to be a consistent message. Here is Sarah Nelson from the Flight Attendants Union talking about this.
The people that I represent in the airline industry, we are looking at mass furloughs on October 1st if Congress does not act this week. We are hearing, actually, that there is incredible bipartisan support to get a deal done. But the leadership has not been encouraging getting that relief in place. So, for example, with the airline industry workers, our jobs are at risk solely because of coronavirus. This is not about failed business plans. This is that the demand does not exist. The airline industry demand is hovering right around 30% right now. And we are expecting, actually, that is going to get worse as we get into the fall and we have more problems with coronavirus, because we're not being honest about the fact that we don't have this pandemic under control. So we're going to continue to be threatened with our jobs and the industry itself. When those layoffs happen, we will also see a cut to rural communities, to small airports. Those airports support jobs as well. Normally, 750,000 U.S. airline jobs support 11.4 million jobs in the economy. So there is a ripple effect. We know that with the plus up of the $600 gone, that is also going to have an impact on people losing their jobs. We know that if coronavirus relief is not in place, we are not going to have the funds to keep up the sanitation in our cities, to keep up the public transportation in our cities. And people are making decisions right now to sell their cars, break their leases, or they're behind in their mortgage payments. We're going to see foreclosures. There is going to be another wave of hurt. And there are people who are stressed out right now, not knowing how they're going to put this together, understanding that they're going to be losing their health insurance and facing terminal illnesses that they're trying to get help for. There are people who don't know where to turn, and the depression is mounting.
Okay, a little different than Kimberly Guilfoyle's message at the Republican convention.
Yeah, and a little more important. This is that what she was saying there paralleled a little bit of what we were just talking about a moment ago, that when she's talking about people selling their cars and making kind of these urgent steps, working class people in this country were hurting already. They weren't in the best of shape before. But they are workers. They are determined to try, and they have hung on as best they can, since March in a lockdown situation, in a slow economy, in a fits and starts reopening that's been terribly handled by the president, by his people around him. There does come a point where you can't, sell another car. You can't, move into a smaller apartment. You can't move in, you can't downsize anymore. And that's where I think, as a society, we come to in the fall. And I think it's going to become a very, very urgent reality. There are two things that are important to my view in this regard. And I was just talking with the president of the United Electrical Workers Union, which is a older union, old CIO union, that's now an independent union that represents about 35,000 workers in a lot of manufacturing, but also public and private sectors. They represent the Willie Street Co-op, among other things, in Madison. And what he was saying is, no matter what you think about Biden, what that union has said is, the November election is the first step. It's not the end of anything. And the first step is getting rid of Trump, because he's absolutely disastrous for working-class people. But the second step is organizing to put massive demands on Biden and whoever is elected in November, because the deficit hawks will be out there. There'll be people saying, oh, we already spent too much. We've already got too much debt or whatever. If they prevail, we will go into a long-term economic crisis. And so this is I think we're at a very pivotal point for working-class America.
Well, I understand that the debt is a big deal, and it does have consequences.
It's real.
But if we want to deal with it, repeal the tax cut.
Well, and cut the Pentagon budget, by the way. And remember, Barbara Lee, Mark Pocan, other folks have proposed cutting the Pentagon budget in an interesting way. They want to provide more protections for the troops, right? Protect their pay, protect their benefits, et cetera, do more. But they want to cut the contractors, the big corporations, the industrial side of that military-industrial complex. And they tried to cut 10%. Which could have been done, very easily, and they were rejected. They were rejected not just by Republicans, but by a lot of Democratic leadership. And so we are in a situation where what we have to recognize is that if indeed the urgency of these economic issues that Sarah Nelson and other people are talking about, if we believe that to be real, then we need to have a emergency plan for immediately upon the point, if Joe Biden is elected, but that he becomes president of the United States. Trump won't save us. We know that. And the fact is that we should be cautious about viewing Joe Biden as a savior. The fact of the matter is he is somebody who will be open to what is demanded, and that makes him a lot better. But the demand still has to be made, and that demand is that Biden can't do what past Democratic presidents have done. Promise a lot on the campaign trail, and then come to power and say, oh, yeah, but we got a lot of debt. I can't do quite as much as what I promised. In this case, he's got to go full Roosevelt, if you will, full FDR, and that is to to recognize that the crisis is so severe that we have to, you know, look at this all in a different way and say we're going to need to cut in some areas where we can, but primarily we will have to spend money. As tough as that is and as unsettling as that is to the deficit hawks, we've got to spend money to get people back to work, to get people the protections they need who are out of work. And frankly, one other thing I would say, step one for Joe Biden, in addition to the humane and decent stuff we're talking about here, is reform labor law. An absolute, flat-out, immediate reforming of labor law, day one, that makes it easy to do, organize a union with card check, and provides just dramatically more protections for collective bargaining.
All right, well, let me ask you this, because, you know, there were a lot of rose-colored glasses when Clinton and Obama were elected. I wasn't under any illusions about Clinton not being a great friend of labor. I know a lot more now than I did then. You certainly were not under any illusions, but Obama had sort of a luster around him, but he'd given signs in the fall campaign that there might be problems. I said to somebody the other day, you know, in some respects, the fact that we're already a little suspicious of Biden might be a good thing in that we stay on top of it this time.
Well, that's it. And look, I do think I'm in the camp that says that Clinton and Obama's circumstances were very, very different. Clinton governed, you know, the better part of 30 years ago, or he came in the better part of 30 years ago, at a point when you still had very moderate Republicans, not all, mind you, some real right-wingers, but you also had, you know, people that you could work with. And Obama came in at a time where there's going to be, where there's absolute obstruction. And so I do think there are some distinctions there. But at the end of the day, what we have to understand is the circumstance that the next president will come into. And if Joe Biden has the presidency, control of the House, and a narrow majority in the Senate, which I do think is possible, the need for pressure on Biden will be all the more, because there will be, you know, some Democrats, a handful of Democrats in the Senate, I guarantee it, who will be like, yeah, yeah, we can do a little, but not too much, right? And there will be Republicans who will try to use Senate rules to block stuff. Biden's going to have to be as strong or stronger than any president since Roosevelt. He will have to say, first and foremost, that he favors a reform of Senate rules that allow the will of the people, that if indeed the people elect a Democratic president, Democratic House, Democratic Senate, the will of the people to prevail and thus to be able to govern. And those Senate rule changes don't have to be a complete scrapping of Senate rules, but they do have to be in recognition of what Senator Jeff Merkley has said, which is that at this point, there are Senate rules that generally benefit Wall Street, benefit corporate America, and at the same time undermine efforts to take care of working class people. And so what you want to do is rebalance the rules so at the very least that they are fair. And frankly, I have no problem if you rebalance them to make sure that they take care of working class people ahead of Wall Street and corporate America.
John Nichols from the Capital Times, my best to you on this Labor Day 2020.
My best to you. Happy Labor Day.
Slysoffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.